Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Microsoft's Group Vice President, Platforms, Jim Altchin.
We're going to have a lot of fun in the next 2 hours. First, we're going to have a little trip down memory lane. How many of you remember Windows 1.0? Huh? How many of you? Well, it's hard to keep it in perspective. It's been so long ago. So I went to the company museum, and I had one shipped down here. Come on over here. I want you to make sure you get a good look at this. Here's an IBM XT. You guys see this? So I have Windows 1.0 on it here. I'm just going to start it up. Look at this thing. See this hourglass? They didn't make hardware fast enough back then either. And I want to bring up one of the games to give you an idea of the graphics power we had. Reverse-y. So why do I bring this up? Because I want to drive home how far the industry has come. And the second is it's because of you that Windows has been so successful, and I want to thank you for all the work that you've done to make the platform successful. It's you. So, this is the beginning of the third decade. That's right, this year, 20th anniversary for Windows. It's awe-inspiring growth. During the first 6 years of Windows 1 through Windows 3, the industry shipped, give or take, about 30 million PCs. Fast forward to 1995. That year, we shipped, give or take, about 60 million. Think about this. During the first 90 to 120 days after Vista ships, we'll surpass that number of PCs shipped. It's mind-blowing. Think about this. Each year, about 500 million people go and buy Windows-related devices. That's a massive opportunity for us. In terms of growth, in terms of just raw numbers, Windows has expanded into all nooks and crannies, if you will. It's in embedded devices. It's in all types of laptops, all types of standard PCs. It's in the living room with the Media Center edition. It's in portable media devices. It's in the phone. It's amazing the type of progress that we've had in that space. The apps from you, incredible line of business apps, incredible games, incredible communications, and incredible entertainment. Now, whether it was back in the early days of 1985, or whether it's today, the first movers are the ones that had the biggest advantage. I want to show you a first mover for Windows Vista. There's a company, an innovative game company called Crytek, that's going to have a game that's going to ship simultaneously with Windows Vista. Now, actually, they won't let me show you the game today, but they will let us show you a video showing some of the power of the platform. You have to understand that the PC will always be ahead of the game consoles in terms of the power, just because it's an extensible platform and can keep evolving. So we're going to roll a video in just a minute, and I want you to look at the realism that is possible. I want you to look at the shadows, the light, the way the leaves move in the wind. Can we roll that video? Now, you could think of Vista as the culmination of the last 20 years, or you could be like me that thinks about it as, this is just the beginning of the next 20 years. And that's what we're going to talk about today. You've seen flashy demos, but for the next 2 hours, we're going to get a little bit dirtier in bits and bytes. I'm going to talk about the Windows platform and give you an overview. I'm going to talk about the four pillars that I talked about at the last PDC, the same four pillars. We're going to do a programming lab. That's right, we're bringing it back, popular demand by some of the architects to come out and show you code samples. We're also going to show you real apps, both a sample app and one from an actual company that's using the Vista platform. And lastly, I'm going to talk about the opportunity for you and for Microsoft, us together. I stood here 2 years ago in this convention center as we were starting the journey for Windows Vista. Since then, we've released two versions of the Media Center, two versions of tablet. We've released a 64-bit client, 64-bit servers, new versions of the server, a massive update of Windows XP SP2 for our customers, and we've shipped Windows Vista Beta 1. Now, at that PDC, I talked about more transparency, and we have been following through in that. We gave you the bits in the early alpha stages of Longhorn, and that feedback was incredibly valuable to us. We've also been providing community tech previews. We've provided four of them so far. We started back in November, where we're trying to get the bits out to you so you can give us the feedback. We're going to continue that today. We're going to be giving you an intermediate build between Beta 1 and Beta 2. It's the build number 5219. It's a build that isn't Beta 2, and it's got lots of issues in it. Nevertheless, it shows our progress that we're making, and we're very proud of the way we're building the software today. The PDC is an important milestone for us. We've got two more after this before we're going to be shipping. Beta 2 will be coming as soon as we feel like we've got it in the bag in terms of the basic set of features, and we will go broad with that to a wide variety of customers and for all the audiences. We feel very confident about broad availability by the end of 2006. Now, why do we feel that confidence? We feel the confidence because we redid the way we were building Windows. During the last 2 years, we completely re-engineered engineering. And maybe in some of these talks around here in Birds of the Feather, we can spend time explaining how we did that, because it's given us more confidence to give out the community tech previews and to know that the builds are going to be of quality. And every day we're cranking out a new build. And it gives us the confidence to know that we're going to be able to hit the end of the year. Now, everybody talks about the internet. Enough people don't talk about the things happening around the internet. Both the internet and all the excitement around the edge of the network is the backdrop for Windows Vista. The internet is the sea we all live in, float in. It's both a destination, but it's also a pipe. And I don't think people understand how incredible the pipe is and what that's going to mean. Now, I want to talk about why I think the edge is so exciting. The proof points. First, hardware abundance. Just think of the power of the CPU. Most smartphones have more power than that machine over there today. Think about the graphics processing units. Incredible power, massive storage, incredible communication bandwidth. How about all the form factors? Everything from the living room, nice AV rack level system, to game players and phones that are basically cosmetic accessories, in tablets where we've made handwriting the next step in the computing. Amazing form factors. Peer-to-peer is another change that's happening in the industry. And I'm not talking about just music. I'm talking about what's happening in terms of being able to share photos or doing video calls or even high-performance computing. That's all about peer-to-peer technology. And that's happening because the internet is just the pipe and the happening area is on the edge. The user model is also changing. It used to be on the internet you would just browse around. Then search became the thing. And today, I think it's more subscription, where you're actually going and getting the information once that you need and having the information come to you so that you can act on that information and do the things that you want to do locally. And you will be acting on that information locally because there's so much power there. You're not going to be editing some video, home video, across the internet for a very long time. I also want to point out that even if you're a destination on the internet, if you look at what's happening, those services are spending their time trying to differentiate on the edge because they want that user interface differentiation. Finally, because of so much happening on the edge, it's also a malicious attack point. And it's something that we, as the operating system company and the platform provider, along with you, have to be very knowledgeable of. Now, the Windows platform was designed specifically for this environment. This picture of the Windows platform, these covering these four diagrams, you remember this? This is the same general picture I showed 2 years ago. Now, why are we unique? We're unique because we have an end-to-end approach to this. All the pillars work together. Now, other companies may have great solutions in one pillar, but you're forced to glue together another pillar, perhaps from another company. You might have a flashy presentation system from one company, but you have to get a data layer from another. In Vista, we've got one model, one common architecture, with components to manage presentation, data, and communications, all built on a safe and reliable foundation. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to just go the next level down and just talk about the architectural principles for each of these. First, presentation. The goal of this pillar is that we want to provide every piece of technology you need for going from HTML to being smart. We include a deep compositing engine that handles vector 2D graphics, 3D images, text, media, all composited together in real time. And if there's hardware, we use the hardware assist. Another important thing that we're doing in this pillar is that you'll find that data is usually trapped in, you know, fairly ugly tables or grids. We're trying to unleash that and let you be able to do rich visualizations to do the binding from data and make apps like never before. In the data space, the goal of this pillar is to store, manage, access, and find data, whether it be local, on the network, or on the internet. Now, this particular pillar has had major breakthroughs since the last PDC. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. But the gist of it is, we know that it's important to be able to access HTML objects and relational data in a common way across multiple stores. And we think that we've found an innovation to help you do that. In the communication space, the goal is to allow apps to communicate securely, reliably, whether it's to devices, systems, or to other people. We've made this system, this pillar, protocol agnostic. Big change from the last PDC. And based on internet standards. Now, all the other layers wouldn't be very interesting if it wasn't for the base system. In this system, we're trying to do something very, very focused in Windows Vista. It's probably got more energy in this pillar than any of the others. We're trying to write better code and have it better tested. I sort of mentioned that earlier. We're also focused on isolation at all levels, whether it be at the network level or whether it be in terms of the way processes actually operate on the system. Great device management and with an incredible focus on deployment and servicing. So that's at the first level. Now let's go deep. You can read this, right? Good, because there's going to be a test on it at the end of this conference. This slide is available on the MSDN site. It's also going to be covered in lots of the sessions. I bring it up because I think this will be helpful as you look at this diagram. I also think it's on ComNet for you to learn the different terms that we're using here so you can map them to the sessions. Vista, as you can see from this diagram, is a very broad and deep system. We've got substantial innovation in each of the pillars and in making them work together. Hundreds of engineers, as Bill said, are here from Microsoft to go deep. And there's something like 150 sessions on this. So there's one other thing I wanted to mention. When you look at the slide, you'll see that we've highlighted the changes since the last PDC. So you can give an idea of the things that we've changed and learned from your feedback. So now, I want to take the next step down again, and I want to talk about the base services. As I said, this is a prime focus area for Windows Vista. hundreds of features, and I have time to only cover a few. Let me talk about deployment and servicing for just a minute. Deployment's a big problem for corporate accounts. They get lots of images that are huge, and they have to have individual images for the different computer environments. What we've done is we've created a new imaging model so that we can pack images together, and we actually do single instancing, so the size is much smaller. We also have offline servicing. Another aspect in the deployment is something we call NAP, or Network Access Protection. That's the idea that you can take a machine who's been out in the wild and bring it into an environment that's protected, and the system goes into quarantine until it passes a certain set of deployment scripts. We've also worked on customer feedback. Customer feedback has really helped us understand what's going on. As systems would get in trouble in the field, we'd get that information from Microsoft, and we also share that with you. For example, some of the information that we've gotten back has shown that some of the problems aren't our software or your software. It's actually hardware. So one of the things we're doing in the reliability space is we're adding hardware diagnostics along with hardware monitoring to the system. So if we start to smell something going on with memory, which may not be ECC'd, then we can do something about it. Or we start to smell that the disk is starting to have faults. We can do something about it. We're also reducing reboots, we believe, at least by 50% in terms of configuration. That's also something that you should work on, and let me explain why. We've added something called a restart manager, a reboot manager in Vista. And if you call that, it can help you decide whether or not certain DLLs, or it'll shut down certain parts of the system and keep the rest of the system running so that you can replace certain DLLs without the system having to reboot. We've also added transacted storage. Transacted storage across the registry, across the file system. In fact, we put a distributed transaction monitor in the system, and you can link your data store into it so that you can get one transacted update across all of them. Let me talk about security for just a minute. There's a lot of information. I've just got a few features on the slide. One I need to talk about here on the slide is called user account protection. I think about it as just running a standard user. That is going to be the default in Windows Vista. And we've corrected the Windows Vista system so that it can operate in a reasonable way running a standard user. You need to make sure that your applications also support that. It's a very key ask that we have of you. On the performance side, let me just give you a demo of some performance stuff. So what I have here is a Windows Vista machine. And have you ever had a machine and it just seems to get slower over time? Well, we're trying to do something about it. The first thing is we're trying to automatically optimize the system so that you don't have to. I mean, why are users have to thinking about defragging the disk and re-optimizing the way the blocks are on the disk? You don't have to with Windows Vista. It just is done automatically. That's the first thing we're doing. The second thing we're doing is doing some great innovation with something that we call SuperFetch. Now, what SuperFetch does is it enhances the virtual memory system, which typically looks over things like maybe seconds and minutes to decide the best usage of memory. What SuperFetch does is look over minutes, days, hours, months, years, and it optimizes the system based on how that system has been used. And the best way to show this is I'm going to come here and I'm going to start a script. And this is without SuperFetch running. This is just going to go through a set of applications and start them up. This is a 512 megabyte system. It's probably got half of the memory available for applications and data. And as you can see, this would be like a Windows XP machine that was cold booted. This is what you would expect. It takes a very long time for Outlook to start because it's also bringing in DLLs that are also used in some of the other Office applications. And it just sits and reads these in. Now, if you were to immediately restart this in XP, you'd get pretty good performance because the virtual memory system would immediately take advantage of the fact that those pages were there. But what if you rebooted? And it doesn't matter how long you waited, it would be the same cost of waiting through this whole event sequence again. Or what if you went away for lunch and came back? Or what if you hibernated? In all those cases, the system was actually slowing down. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to make the system cold again. It's just going to clear memory. Now I'm going to start Superfetch. And I'm going to bring up a monitor that I've got here. And I want you to just look at the green line here. And what's happening is this system is now prefetching all the programs and data that over a long period of time has been used on this machine. And it's just bringing them into memory. And we will remember this coming back from Hibernate. We'll remember it on boot and the like. So if you don't touch your machine, it's sitting there optimizing it, getting it ready to do the things that you typically do, only do them faster. So if I run that same script, let's just see how the performance goes. I didn't even let Superfetch complete, but you can get an idea. This cool or what? So Superfetch works great if you have a reasonable amount of memory, and it looks fantastic if you have boatloads of memory. But what if you don't have boatloads of memory? Wonder what you would do then. Well, we thought about that. We said, you know, a lot of people have these USB memory sticks. I wonder if we could take advantage of those and make them part of the virtual memory system. I just plugged in this USB memory stick, any USB memory stick, and as soon as it recognized, we just got another 500 megs of memory on this machine. And as you can see, Superfetch is just taking advantage of all of it. Now you say, oh, well, what if you pull it out? Will I lose data? No, you won't, because we do write through. You say, oh, well, what if I pull it out? Can I bring it to another machine and somebody could steal my data? No, you can't, because we encrypt it. And we actually do 2x encryption, so even on fairly small keys, we can take advantage of it. We think this is a great innovation that will make Windows Vista get faster over time and make it more applicable even on a laptop where you may not be able to add the memory. I want to move and talk about... I want to show you another demo. This time, it's about how we've taken and been able to run them in what we call low integrity mode. I talked about standard user, and if you have standard user, you know that you can't hurt the operating system and you can't hurt another user, but you sure could hurt yourself. You could wander around and get some bad information, and it could perhaps damage the data on your machine. Well, what we really wanted to do is run certain processes in low integrity mode so they're actually sandboxed and protected from the rest of your data. And that's exactly what we did in Windows Vista. What I've got on this machine is it's a Windows Vista machine running a VPC, and I've got IE here. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to just start IE. And what I just did is I visited an awful, evil website. And as you can see, it just downloaded a batch file and put it in my startup group. Now, if in fact there was a vulnerability in IE, this is a possibility. How about Vista? I'm going to bring up that startup group so you can also see it. I'm just going to go to that same web page. And if you notice down here, it says the create file failed. And in fact, the folder for the startup group is empty. Very simple demo. This is incredibly powerful because it's not just IE. So you can create sandboxes around processes so that they can be protected from the rest of your data. We think this is an incredible innovation. It means that even if we don't, as we all can't write perfect code, even if we don't capture all the vulnerabilities, IE is still protected. Your data is still protected. We think this is an incredible innovation. I would love to spend time. In fact, we had all these other demos. But because this talk is going to go so long, I'm not going to be able to show them to you. But if you go to some of the sessions, they will be able to show you many of the demos that I wish I had time to show you here. I want to move to the next pillar, which is the presentation pillar. There are many challenges at this layer of the system. Our goal is for you to be able to write faster applications, make it easier to write. We want to improve the usability for the users through incredible new look and feel. We want you to be able to stand out in the way you do your applications. We want to help you target different form factor devices. We want to give you facilities to do rich along with smartness, and we want to integrate designers into the process. There are amazing number of expectations that customers have today. Now, Microsoft pioneered some of the best techniques for doing some of the current state-of-the-art web systems today. You can look at the Outlook web access and see how much better that is than how Hotmail is. Hotmail is going to be changed to use the same technology, but you can get a contrast there between doing incredible things in terms of DHTML and just doing the standard things. The next level up, people have tried to create rich islands by dropping down ActiveX controls, and within that island, it's pretty cool, but it doesn't interface with the rest of your app or the rest of your page. And in the smart client space, we have lots of innovations that we've been working on through the years, whether it be in WinForms, DirectX, Win32, and all the great stuff in Office. That's the world the way it is today. We know that we can do better, and we're going to do that in Vista. One of the things that I want to talk to you today about is something called Atlas. Now, today, most browsers support DHTML, JavaScript, and HTML, HTTP. And many cool websites are now using those. Generally, people talk about this as AJAX technology, asynchronous JavaScript and XML. What it shows to me is a demand for richer experiences. Now, if you have done any of this code today, you know it's pretty hard. You have to be an expert in DHTML and JavaScript, and you better understand all the differences in the different browsers, and there's subtle differences. And you better be good with some tools, because the tools aren't as great as they could be. And debugging is, frankly, pretty hard. So what we're trying to do is create a framework, extension of ASP.NET, that lets you build rich web experiences without the pain that you're currently going through in terms of doing this client-side scripting. So we're providing this client framework. It runs in any DHTML-compatible browser, and it's deeply integrated in with the familiar tools that you're already used to. And you'll see a demonstration of that in just a minute. Now, the Windows presentation layer foundation is a piece of software that's composed of two pieces, an engine and a framework. Now, we think that we are light years ahead of everybody in this space. In the engine, we have a single runtime that can be browser-based, forms-based, graphics, video, audio, documents, all composited together in real time, as I said before. Now, what does this mean for you? And I'm not talking about just the desktop. I'm talking about your apps. Have you ever tried your app on a high DPI monitor? Does it look good? Well, if you've written into the engine and using this technology, you don't have to think about high DPI monitors anymore, because we do the work for you. It's not special APIs that you have to use. It just happens automatically. The other piece of the Windows Presentation Foundation, and as Bill said, this used to be called Avalon, is this framework. It's an extensible environment where you can subclass the controls that we provide, or you can write brand new controls. You can use a declarative markup language that we call XAML, or you can use a procedural language, and we can do the rest for you. Now, wouldn't it be nice to have a subset of this on devices so you could target them? Or how about other systems? Well, we've been asked, and we're introducing something called WPF/E, the Windows Presentation Foundation / Everywhere. Now, this is very early work, but the concept is that we're going to create an interactive experience on devices and the PC. It's a strict subset of the Windows Presentation Foundation. It's a lightweight download. The programming model is XAML, but instead of procedures like C#, we're going to use JavaScript. You have access to all the WPF tooling that you currently have. And this is something that you're going to be able to start providing feedback to us basically now. And I think the best thing to do for to sort of wrap together all this particular pillar is to see a demo. Before I show you the demo, I want to show you how this all looks when you piece it together. We think that we've taken each of the areas that we were a little bit weak in before and expanded beyond anything anyone else in the industry has done. So let's look at all the pieces together with a demo. I'd like to invite out Darren Deacon to walk through a demo. Hey, Darren.
Thanks, Jim. Jim, I know you love movies.
I do.
And I know you use the Netflix online service
Absolutely.
To order them. Great service, as many of the people in the audience use. There's a couple things. We've been working with them over the last few weeks, along with their website design partner, Resonate, to build a Vista exploitive application using some of the technologies that you just talked about. There were really three things that we were trying to accomplish with the application. The first is to create a much more compelling user experience that's more usable and interactive than what you could do today with the existing technologies on the web. The second thing is to use software as a way to differentiate the software that they create and the experience they have from their competition. And the third thing is, being a media company, they want to run on a wide variety of devices. So what we've done is we've created a Netflix application using Windows Presentation Foundation that runs on a PC, on a tablet, on a media center, as well as on a cell phone. So let's take a look.
Sure.
So the first thing you'll see here is this is a WPF application. Netflix exposes all of their data using an RSS feed. So what we've done is we've used WPF to create rich data visualization of those services and to visualize that here in this application. You'll notice across the top here, we have a list of recommended videos that they have. We have a top 10 list. I can scroll through
100.
This. Top 100. I can scroll through this list and see different information. There's the recommended list, things like that. Let's take a look at one of these. As I hover over, I can get more information on these, and you'll see some nice little animations there. Here I have a synopsis. You know, it tells me a little bit about the movie. I can get more information on the cast. I can even go and see a review on that using the community of Netflix users that are out there. And again, all this data is coming in over an RSS feed. So, highly rated movie. Let's add this to our queue. Here's another one, Mad Hot Ballroom. Looks sort of like a good one. What do you think?
Yeah, it sort of fits with the music we started off with.
That's right. Let's take a look. Here's a new menu item called Previews. If I click on that, directly within the application, I'm able to view high-quality video. You notice here I can still navigate to the other menu items, see different information, go to the preview. I can control the video directly in line here. Let's add that one to our queue as well. I'm a huge Sopranos fan, and this weekend I was thinking about adding some of these, so I'm just going to go here and add a couple of these videos. Here's another one I see. You know, one more. Boy, I love those animations, don't you?
Yeah.
And just keep adding them all day long.
Well, what's this at the top?
Should I add another one here just for fun? This thing across the top is called the accordion view. When I have movies in my queue, I'll generally have 80 to 100 items in there, which makes it hard to visualize all those on one page. So what we've done is we've created this accordion view, which allows me to expand and contract all these things using the 3D capabilities of Avalon, and I can see everything within my queue. You'll also notice here I have an expand tab so that if I want to see a bigger picture of what my queue looks like and reorder some of those things, I'm able to do that. We all just saw Napoleon Dynamite in Bill, so why don't we move that one to the back? So we can move that one, the back here, and I'll scroll through here a little bit. And those Sopranos movies that we just stuck into our queue, why don't we click on those and move those to the front of the queue? So just by simply clicking a couple buttons here, I'm able to simply, manage the movies in my queue. And you'll notice here up in the accordion view, the view has been updated. And one last thing on this application, you'll notice here, based on the items in my queue, Netflix is making recommendations for me. So right here, it's using additional screen real estate to give me suggestions on other movies that are available. Pretty cool application, huh?
Super cool.
So why don't we take a look at it now? Thank you. Why don't we go over here to a tablet and take a look at what this application would look like on a tablet? You'll notice here that, is it on the screen? Not yet. Can we get the tablet on the screen? Yes. It's on, okay. So what you'll notice here is it's the same application that we had before. This is running on a new gateway tablet using a widescreen display. And the nice thing about Windows Presentation Foundation is it's able to use the screen real estate that's available with very little developer coding. So in this case, WPF has automatically relayed out the images of the videos to take advantage of that screen real estate. And you'll notice here I can use a stylus, very simple stylus, as my input mechanism. So here I can click on some of these and get more information just like I did in the other application. I can see the synopsis, I can see the ratings, and I can even add that to my queue. And you notice the other thing I want to be able to do is to use this stylus on this cool accordion view up here. And so as I hover over this thing, I'm able to, just with a simple stylus, navigate that particular accordion view.
Great.
So pretty cool, huh?
How about on devices?
Well, there's one more thing.
Oh, how about the media center?
Exactly. How do you like my new big screen media center back here?
Is this yours?
Why don't we project this up here? What do you think?
Okay.
Yeah, how would you like to have one of these in your home? I would.
It's why the power went down yesterday.
That's right. So let's see, can we get the feed up here? So what you're going to see in here is we're running that same application running on the Windows Media Center Edition. So let me navigate down to More Programs, and you'll see the Netflix application on the menu there. So I'll click on that and launch the application. You'll notice it's a very similar user experience. Across the top, I have my recommended list. I could scroll over to the top 100 again. I can see, scroll through all the list of videos down here. I'm going to go back to my recommended list. There we go. There's a couple things that developers need to think about when they're targeting the media center. First of all, they need to be able to use a remote control to navigate, which means all the menu functions need to be simply available using up, down, left, right, and the OK button. The input device is automatically handled by the Windows Presentation Foundation. So developers just need to write a little bit of code to make those menu items and functions easily accessible. The second thing is everything needs to be very big and bold, because you'll be sitting in your recliner watching a video, and you're 10 feet away or so. You want those icons and the menus and everything to be big and bold. With Windows Presentation Foundation, you're able to scale that user interface up very easily with just a small amount of code to optimize it, for the media center. And finally, you want the focus to be in the middle, so the user can easily see what they need to do in order to work with that application. So using Windows Presentation Foundation, it's very easy to create this. The other thing, Netflix is a media application, sort of obvious you want to watch a video on here. So let's watch a trailer of this particular video here. You'll see in line in the application, I'm able to simply... There it goes. So I'm able to simply get that video, that live trailer, within the context of my application and see it, you know, so Netflix can control the branding and everything of their app. So let's close this out. And we have one last thing to show, Jim, and that is I talked about devices a little bit. And so here we have a very cool new iMate Jazz Jar device. It's a 500 megahertz processor. It has two cameras. It has an integrated keyboard. The screen swivels around. I can use a stylus to navigate it. Very cool device. And so we've created a version of Netflix, in this case using the .NET Compact framework, which is available today. In the future, you'll be able to use the new WPFE technology to make it even richer to run on this particular device. So let's take a quick look here. I'll pull out a stylus. So in this case, I have the same application. I'm able to navigate back and forth with it, and I can click on this details page and see, you know, the same details that were available in all these other experiences. And I'm even able to view a rich preview directly in line in that particular application. It's being streamed down.
Is this cool or what?
Not bad, huh? And there's one last thing before I leave that I think is the most cool thing about this entire demo. The folks I talked about from Resonate, about a month ago, we approached them and said, hey, we have this opportunity. You know, we want to partner with Netflix. How would you like to help us out? With three developers and one graphic designer, they were able to create the Netflix application that runs on the PC, that runs on the tablet, that runs on the media center, and that runs on this device in 1 month with three developers. That's pretty incredible. So with that, I'll turn it back to you.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
You know, when we were preparing for this conference, the team came to me and said, hey, we've got this really cool device. And they showed it to me, and they said, I think a lot of people at the PDC might like this device. And they said, but it's greater than $1,000 retail. They said, can you help me out? So together with partners, we're making this available for the people here at this conference in a limited supply for the low price of $149. And you can go to ComNet and get in line for the limited supply. It's hard to do this with a straight face, but wait, there's more. For the first 250 people, you can get a Plantronics 320 Bluetooth headset for this for only, guess how much, $995. So we are trying to help you out. And of course, everything about this device is being covered in some of the sessions here, so you can go to the breakouts and learn how to program this device. So don't rush out right now and try to get this. Just connect on to ComNet, and they'll explain how you can go ahead and get this. I want to move on to the data pillar. I said earlier this was the biggest area of innovation since the last PDC. I want to read the challenges here, because we've updated them some. How do I find and update information across different stores? How can I subscribe to the information I want? How can you use and expose the metadata and schema easily? And how can I share information with others? Our conclusion, with your feedback and some of the work that we've done, is that a single store isn't enough and that many stores are going to be the reality. We know that WinFS has innovations that no other store has or will have. But we also know that you need both the access to and updating capability to multiple stores. We are approaching this by addressing the impedance mismatch between the programming languages and the data. We also conclude that subscriptions are fundamental along with sharing. So what are we doing about it? First, we've created a uniform programming model called LINQ, for Language Integrated Query, that we're going to demonstrate in just a few minutes. What we do is we're integrating data operators directly into the language. And these operators work across whether it be objects, XML, or relational. And you get early drops of this at this conference. Second thing we're doing is we're continuing to invest in search and organization technology. In Windows Vista, you can search locally, you can search across your intranet, or you can search on the internet. We do this across multiple data types, whether it be mail or whether it be documents of another form. And we've made search such that you can produce the metadata or so that you can use the search functionality directly in your application. As Chris demonstrated earlier, we've built a rich RSS platform for subscriptions directly in Windows Vista. It's a single store for the applications, so it's a real platform. It's not some simple app. So you can do your own RSS work. And you get all the benefits of the indexing technology that's built in. Now, WinFS is still under construction. You get bits on the DVDs that we're going to give out today. We would like feedback on WinFS to know if we're still on the right track. We think we are. We want that feedback. So I want to move on to the communications pillar. How can I write one program that talks to everything? How can I manage identity and access between applications? How do I make it work across the peer-to-peer network? How do I create applications that cross trust boundaries? And how do I ensure reliable and secure connections? Net-net, how can I write one app that's going to talk to everything in a polymorphic way? And that's what we've been doing in the Windows Communication Foundation. It's a unified communications platform for writing distributed apps. Now, we've made great innovations based on your feedback in this particular pillar. We've greatly simplified. We've unified the concepts of transport and channels. We've integrated ports into the concept of channels. We've made the system protocol agnostic. Last BDC, we were talking about WS star only. Now we've integrated REST/POX and MSMQ. We've also integrated peer-to-peer directly in the system. And because identification is such a big problem, we've created a new federated ID model that we call info cards. Now, what are info cards? Now, we've been this path before, but it's done totally different this time. We've learned an awful lot. We've learned that you want open standards. You want anyone to be able to develop their own implementations so that there can be lots of different ID authorities. So basically what we have is an abstraction layer that covers different ID providers with a common UX dialogue that hides those differences to users. So all you have to do is write to a couple APIs, and you get identity independence easily. Now, I've been talking about communications, so I want to show you a quick peer-to-peer app before we start the lab. Now, have you ever been in a coffee shop where you wanted to share with another person there, perhaps in a different company, so there's no common infrastructure between you, or been in a conference room where you have a vendor in and you want to share, say, a PowerPoint? Well, we have a new technology called People Near Me that's the basis for the communications of PeerNet that we have in Windows Vista. So what I think I'd like to do is have Darren Deacon come back out and help me demonstrate an experience which we're including in Windows Vista. The main reason to show this experience isn't specifically about the experience, but to show you the type of apps that you could build in yourself. So I'm going to bring up this Windows collaboration experience. I'm going to start a new session here. I'll call it PDC.
I've already logged on my machine here, Jim.
Okay, great. And I'm going to type a password, and I'm going to start this session. So what's happening now is it's searching and creating that session, and you should be getting a pop-up momentarily.
So what this is doing is over the peer-to-peer network, sending an invitation to me and allowing me to subscribe to that session that you just created, right?
So I've got Daryl here, just found him.
Yep, here I go.
I'm going to send him an invitation.
I'm going to accept it here. I'm joining the session.
There. So now that he's accepted, I can see it on my screen. What I'm going to do is I want to project this PowerPoint presentation. So I'm just going to drop it into the session. And as you can see, he can see it on his screen. And if I go into project mode, he can see it. In fact, any of the people that are created in this PeerNet environment could see that same presentation. And I could walk through the presentation here. You could look at it. You think this presentation's right?
I don't think so. I think we need to make one quick change to this.
Okay.
Based on some data.
Let me send you over the PowerPoint.
Okay, so peer-to-peer, it's just sending that file over. I see it over here in my handout section, so I'm going to double-click on that, and it's going to open up PowerPoint in here. We've had a little over budget here, so I think we need to change the title of this presentation real quick to the Lab Over Budget Plan. I'm going to save this, and using the file replication services in Windows Vista, it will take that file and replicate those changes back to you, so you should be able to open it back on your desktop now.
And there's the over budget.
And be able to see
it. That's cool. Thank you very much.
Yep.
The important thing on this particular demonstration is not the particular experience, which we haven't completed yet for Windows Vista, but it's to think about how you and your application could take advantage. This is very, very cool underpinnings. It uses IPv6, so it makes it through lots of NATs and firewalls. It uses the file replication capability, and it creates a peer net. Even if you don't have an infrastructure node in wireless, it'll automatically put the system in an ad hoc mode. And you can just use it through some simple APIs. Okay, how about some code? I've asked four architects to come out during the next 40 minutes and walk through each of the pillars. So I've got Don, Anders, Scott, and Chris. They're going to touch on all these different areas that I've been talking about in Vista. Don? Hey.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Jim. I got an itch. I got to write some code. I got ants in my pants, and I need to code. So just to tell you quickly what we're going to do, on the data front, we're going to look at having a single programming model for query and transformation over any kind of information source. We call that link. On the communications front, we're going to see that we've got a single programming model for hooking up software and applications, be they web applications, enterprise applications, any kind of application. We call that Indigo. And on the presentation side, we're going to see a programming model that spans all kinds of devices and embraces, in fact, celebrates the distinction between the programmer and the designer slash artiste. So, without further ado, I'd like to bring out my good friend Anders Heilsberg to tell you about Link.
Thank you, Don. Thank you. Okay, before I get started, I want to ask you one question. In your applications, how many of you access data? I know. It's sort of a stupid question, but what I take away from that, see your hands and that laughter, is that when you're writing your data applications in C# or VB, you're not just having to master C# and VB, you're having to also probably master SQL and master the APIs that bind these two worlds together. And this isn't always the easiest of programming experiences. In fact, I often have, all too often, have programmers tell me that they feel more like plumbers than programmers when writing data-intensive apps. Now, what we're doing here with Project Link is that we are taking the concepts of query, set operations, and transformations, and we're making them first class in the .NET platform and in the .NET programming languages. Rich queries that you could previously only write in SQL or in XQuery, you can now write in C# or VB, going against any kind of data source, be it objects, relational, or XML. Thank you. Don has on his box here installed a tech preview of the Link project that we are handing out on DVDs after this keynote session, so you can go install and experiment it with it yourself. And we're going to start some code here, write a little project. We're going to try first to query some in-memory data. The ground rule with Link really is that you can query any .NET array or collection. If it implements IEnumerable of T, you can query it. In fact, if you can for each it, you can query it. So we're going to try and just query some in-memory array. So we're going to include system.diagnostics, and then we're going to call process.getProcesses to get ourselves an array of processes. And then we're going to write a query. So we're going to say from P in process.getProcesses, and let's say we are only interested in those processes that have a working set of more than 4 megabytes. So we're going to say where p.workingset greater than 4 megabytes. And from that, well, Don is not very good with hex here. So, and from that, we're gonna select out the process name and the working set.
So we don't have to get all of that information. We just pull out the piece
just
we want.
Just the pieces that we're interested in. Now, in this query, you're seeing a whole host of new language features that I'm not going to get into right now, but that we will cover in the talks that come later. Now, the result of this query is itself something that can be enumerated. So let's write a for each loop and see what the result of the query is. So for each item in the query, let's console.writeline. And Don will do a bit of formatting codes here.
Would you like to help me with this, since you are the only person on the planet who knows all
How
of the formatting codes?
0, comma, minus 30.
Yes, very intuitive.
Very intuitive. Yes.
Do you put this on your resume, Anders?
And then 1, comma, 10.
Not minus 10.
Colon.
Colon. No. N 0?
N 0. Let's do N 0.
Okay.
How many of you know
it will be on the test. Please remember.
Okay. And then we're going to print out the process name and the working set. So let's try and run. And here we see the result of our query. Thank you. Processes, working sets. Now, one thing we notice here is that this stuff isn't ordered by anything. So why don't we add an order by clause to our query? Oh, not.
Oh, sorry. Don't hit.
There we go. No, order by. And let's order it by p.workingset descending. So let's get all of the memory hogs first. And let's try and run the query now.
And here and we you know, see. I'm curious, Anders, what if I scroll to the top of the list will I find here?
Ooh.
Emacs would have been even higher.
Moving right along. Link isn't just about querying in-memory data. It is also about querying relational and XML data. In fact, as part of Link, we're introducing a new API called D-Link that gives you language-integrated query for relational data and allows you to map tables and databases onto classes and objects in C# and VB. The first thing we're going to do is just go to SQL Analyzer and look at a little table that we have in a database here. We have a table called Process Descriptions that contains 2 columns, process name and description. So basically, we have a bunch of descriptions keyed by their process name. Now, in order to access this data in our program, we're going to declare 2 classes that map the data into the object world. First class we're going to write is a process description class that has 2 fields, process name and description. These could have been properties. And then we have some CLR metadata that map these fields onto columns in the database. And finally, we have a piece of metadata that maps the class itself onto a table name in the database. Now, the second class we write is a class that represents the database itself. It's a strongly typed representation of the database. And in here, we simply declare 1 instance variable representing the process descriptions table and then an attribute that maps it onto the database. And that's all we need to do. Now we can access the database as objects. So we're going to create a new instance of the process description database. And this really, think of it as a strongly typed connection to the database. And let's just see that we actually have the data. So let's write a for each loop where we just say for each item in db.processDescriptions. And you see we get statement completion on our database here, everything. And now we can just console.WriteLine the contents of the table. And item.description. So write out process name and description. And let's try and run that. Whoop, let's scroll back. So at the top here, well, why don't you put a read line in there?
Fine.
Just so we can see that what's what here. There we go. Just pause right there. So here we see this very same table, but now we're accessing it directly in C#. Now, the next thing we're going to do now is we're going to actually join these two pieces of information, the in-memory array and the data from the database. So we're going to modify our original query, and we're going to select out one additional column called description, and the value of that column, or that field, rather, we want to be a nested query. So we're going to say from D in process descriptions, our database table, where D.processName equals p.processName, so join on the process name, select out the description. And then finally, we're going to call first.default on the result of this query to just get the first that we get back, or null if there wasn't any entry. And let's run it and see what happens. Oh, one thing, of course, we need to do is we need to go modify our console.WriteLine and also get rid of the read line.
Oh, yes, that would be very convenient.
That got you a little worried there.
My heart rate went up a little bit. Thank you, Anders, yes.
There we go. Let's try and run it. And here we now see a join of these two, of in-memory data with data in the database.
Thank you.
To paraphrase our group vice president, now what would you pay?
Well, actually, let's just pause a little bit and think about what you would have had to write here previously. You would have had to open a connection to the database, new up a SQL command, new up parameter objects, put all of that stuff together, write a SQL query in strings without IntelliSense or statement completion, pray that it works, have it shipped over, get a data reader back, sit and iterate in a loop and manually cast all the data to the appropriate data type. So there's a lot of stuff that just is plumbing work that we're now doing for you automatically. Now, the last thing I want to show here is how we can turn the result of this query into XML. Part of the Link project is an API called XLink that effectively is a language-integrated query-enabled object model for XML. Think of it as a modernized DOM. Now, a key cool feature of XLink is the ability to do functional construction of XML. That's what we'll do here. So we're going to new up an XML element, and we're actually, what better format to put this XML into than RSS form? So we're going to new an element with the tag name RSS. And one of the things we can do with XLink is that we can specify the contents of the XML element as part of its construction. So here, we're adding an attribute to the element, and then we're adding a nested element called title with the text process description. And then what we need channel in here.
Yes, we do. Thank you.
Don will add a channel up there.
Good to know I've got schema cop in the room.
Channel, and then.
Yes, open.
There we go. And then inside channel, we want title and process descriptions. And now, what we want now in our document is a list of all of the items in the query. So we're going to write a nested query here from P in query. The query we had just above, select new X element. So for each item in the query, create a new X element called item containing sub elements title, containing the process name, and description containing the description. And let's close off some parens.
I want that to look beautiful.
There you go. One more. Okay, and now the final thing we're just going to do is console.WriteLine the XML. Why shouldn't we just be able to, in the toString method, get XML out of an XML object? There we go. And let's run it. Let's see what happens. Boom. Now we have the result of our query as XML. Let's scroll to the top, and you can see that we basically get RSS version 2.0 channel title and then a bunch of items that were converted into XML. So that's a very, very quick look at the Link project. If this sort of got you your curiosity up, go to our track lounge, get a white paper on the Link project, and also come see my in-depth talk on this tomorrow at 1:45. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Anders.
Thanks, Tom.
What do you think? It's okay? Keep going? All right. So we've seen Link. Next thing we're going to do is talk about how we're going to take this program, which just runs inside of a single little app domain, and make it span the internet, make it span the enterprise, make it accessible to all kinds of other programs. To help me out on this, I'd like to bring back my partner in crime, Mr. Chris Anderson. Please give it up for Chris. Thank you, Chris. So Indigo at its heart is a messaging system. And so what we're going to do is take the code that we just wrote, and instead of spewing the XML to the console, what we're going to do is take that XML and turn it into a message. So to prepare for doing this, what I'd like you to do is go up and define a new class at the top level of the namespace. Call a public class lapped service and simply have one method, have it be public, have it return a message. Message is a type that's built into Indigo, and call it handle message, and have it take one parameter, which is a message. Now, for this to compile, we're going to need to bring in the DLLs that we use in Indigo. So could you go to add reference and bring in system.serviceModel, system.runtime.serialization, which are the two DLLs that we use to build Indigo. And we're also going to bring in a couple of glue DLLs, because we're going to show how this stuff integrates with both Link and with Atlas. That stuff obviously isn't in the bits that you've got. It's some experimental stuff that, you know, maybe we'll see crash on the screen again. So let's go ahead and just add ref those things. This should now, if you add system.serviceModel to the namespaces, which I'm sure you've already done.
Using the great refactoring support in Visual Studio 2005.
Good product pitch. Good for you, Chris. You've got a career in marketing coming. I can feel it, baby.
I'm working on it.
What I'd like you to do, Chris, is go grab main. Take main. Remove the entire contents of main from main. And paste it in some place. Here's your creative window. Paste it wherever you would like, Chris.
Okay.
Good choice. Now, that console.write line, that's so 1980s. We got to get rid of that thing.
Gone.
What we're going to do now is we've got some glue code to integrate the Xlink stuff with Indigo. I'd like you to go grab those glue files out of the snippets directory. We will be showing these. We will be shipping these on our blogs, whatever. You can see the code. There's not much there. We just haven't done all the integration in the products yet. So what I'd like you to do now is cons up a new message.
Okay.
So to do that, I'd like you to say return xmessage dot create message. Messages have two things. They have an action, which is just the identifier. Pick a URI. Please go nuts. That's a wonderful one.
I'm creative today.
Secondly, put the XML in the message. Lovely. Close, close, close. We now have an Indigo service. We're done writing the service code.
Yeah, it's not very exciting yet.
It's very dull.
Yeah.
What we need to do is Indigo, at its heart, is all about making two pieces of software work together. And the way we reason about how software works together is using these things called contracts. So we need to write a contract really quickly to describe that thing we just did. So if you could define what we call in the Indigo team the universal contract.
That quick.
This is the... You are a very fast typist, Chris. You've got all kinds of skills. So this contract basically says, I take any kind of message, and I'll give you any kind of message. So this describes the universe of all possible applications. Why don't you go ahead and implement that sucker? And now we're done. Our code is complete. We've got a piece of CLR code that now can talk any kind of protocol, integrate with any kind of program. To make it exposed to the world, we need some endpoints. Right? The way we get endpoints is by creating a service.
Okay.
Go down into main.
In main.
What I'd like to do is bring in the hosting code that allows us to take a CLR class that implements a service contract and spew it out to the world. And in this case, what we're going to do is say make a service host, have it bind to our CLR type, and we're going to add an endpoint with the basic HTTP binding. This is SOAP 1.1, HTTP, very vanilla, very ASMX-esque. Come up with an address that you feel comfortable with, and we're going to bind it to the contract. In Indigo, endpoints are addresses, which are the names of the endpoints, bindings, which are details of how the protocol works, and contracts, which describe the interactions.
Perfect.
You got an endpoint. Why don't you put a little console write line, read line action there at the bottom? And start your engine, so to speak. Good
running.
Sign.
It's just good
now,
sign.
At the last PDC, we showed you an Indigo that embraced XML. It embraced SOAP. And it used HTTP. And one thing we heard from the community since the last time we were here is, I need more access to the HTTP-ness of my application. And so to get the HTTP integrated into my program, we've done some work in the basic HTTP transport channel to allow full access to the richness of HTTP. So if you're writing HTTP GET and you want to have URLs, that works. If you want to write a full Restafarian app, you're in there. So what we're going to do now is surf to our page using the browser, and we have a little bit of a problem. Something happened. Why don't you do a view source? Ah. So we supported HTTP GET out of the box. That works great. The problem is, the basic assumption of SOAP is, we don't know what you're going to do, so we have this extensibility model with headers. If all you're doing is simple data transfer over HTTP, and you don't want the SOAP, we have the ability to rinse it off prior to leaving the app domain. So Chris, would you go back to the program? And where it says basic HTTP binding, will you change it to POX binding? POX binding is a little piece of code written by my good friend Doug Purdy that basically rinses the SOAP as the messages go out and lathers them up as they come back in, so that we always have SOAP in the programming model. So why don't you go ahead and run that thing now, and now if you hit refresh, good God, y'all.
It's beautiful.
That is a UI. Can you guys do that well in Avalon?
We're working on it.
Yeah, I thought so. Yeah, that's great. I love that. Cool. So we saw that writing an Indigo service is pretty simple. You write a piece of CLR code, you write a contract, you wire it up, and you're done. Now, I know that we're going to do some integration with my code and this code that we've been writing later on with both you and Mr. Guthrie.
Yes.
And because, you know, we're architects, right, with a capital A, you know, we did very contract-first development, so we sat around and wrote a WSDL file and got all, you know,
ankle-brackety. That's what happens when we have a few drinks, we write WSDL. That's great.
Yeah, exactly. So why don't you bring in the, we took the WSDL file we wrote and ran the service util tool on it to bring in the contract definition into a way we can program with. And there's a contract called lap contract. What I'd like you to do is go up to our service and implement it. So we've got lap contract in the list. There's a couple of methods which are variations on the ones we've written already. The difference is, instead of producing unbounded XML, these adhere to a stricter schema, and we actually use the data contract system to make the schema integrate with our programming language. So why don't you go ahead and inject, we have get processes, which just does a query exceedingly similar to the one Anders and I just worked on. And then we have a second function called match processes that does the same thing, except it takes a regular expression as an argument and narrows the scope of the processes I'm getting to only ones whose names match a pattern. So we've got our contract. Now, I know Scott is just itching to come out here and show us how to write a client program. But here's the issue. Scott's programs, his programs run in a browser, right? Scott works on ASP.NET, he works on Atlas. Web browser is a great thing. But we want to be able to integrate them with this service-oriented world that we live in with Indigo. So we got a little problem. You know that term you hear, AJAX, right? Asynchronous JavaScript XML. Well, it's a little bit of a misnomer, right? One of the problems we've got is not every web browser has XML support. Internet Explorer does. Other browsers do. A lot of browsers don't. So the DHTML JavaScript community that were so inspired at PDC 97 when we showed them IE4 and IE5 and now have embraced that lifestyle have coined this new protocol called JSON, which is the JavaScript Object Notation. It's an alternative textual representation that many of these AJAX apps use to communicate between the relatively impoverished environment of the browser and JavaScript and the back end, which might be anything.
Right.
So turns out that my good friend Steve Main wrote this lovely binding for us, which is, you know, part of our machine here. which allows us to serve up endpoints using the JSON protocol. So what I'd like you to do is go to the app.config file. Most of the time, by the way, let me be clear, we programmatically added the endpoint just to get ourselves bootstrapped. Indigo assumes that you can do whatever you want, but we assume the default usage is the contracts and the code are in the DLL, the endpoint addressing and protocol information is in the configuration system. So let's demonstrate that principle here by bringing in a service configuration element. So what Chris is going to do is bring in a service configuration element. That's not it, Chris.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh. That's the one phrase I hate hearing in these labs. Much better.
Much better.
So why don't you change that to lab service?
It's much better, yes. Lab service.
So we've got lab service. We've got the lab contract. This is that WSDL-based contract that we talked about before. The binding is the JSON binding that Steve Main wrote for us. We've got an address, which is demo whack JSON. And we're going to load this behavior. That's it. So we've now got a fully enabled DHTML, JavaScript extravaganza. I can't think of anyone more qualified to write the client for this thing than our good friend, Scott Guthrie. Scott, will you come on out?
Thanks, Tom. So what we've shown here is how you can go ahead and query for process information using Link and expose it to the web using the richness of Indigo services. What Chris and I are going to go ahead and do over the next two segments is show now how you can build a rich UI presentation on top of it. First, using a broad reach web client using new Atlas technology, and then targeting Windows, rich Windows clients using Avalon. So as Jim mentioned earlier, Atlas is a new framework that we're releasing that enables developers to more easily build richer Ajax-enabled web apps. Specifically, Atlas delivers two kind of core components. One is a rich client-side library of JavaScript that you can take advantage of and provides kind of a rich object-oriented environment to do common Ajax and rich UI browser tasks. The second piece, then, is a set of server-side technologies that's integrated within ASP.NET and kind of nicely encapsulates and integrates it in a way that you feel familiar if you're using an ASP.NET developer today. So what we're going to go ahead and do in this project is just go ahead and import and add an existing web project into the solution we've been working on, which is a web project. It's going to be taking advantage of the new Atlas project type that we actually just released on the web about an hour and a half ago that you can download and use on top of VS 2005 Beta 2 today. And specifically, you'll see within this project, we have a number of script libraries, which are the Atlas script libraries. And then we also have a page called default.aspx that we'll be working on as we build up our UI. And right now, this default.aspx has no server-side code in it at all, and it also actually has no client-side code. It's just a pure HTML page.
So it has no code.
So it has no code.
No client, no server.
Code-free.
Code-free.
Just sans code.
Just tags. And basically, you can see here we have a couple of UI elements. We have a text box for searching processes, a button, and then a span. And what we want to go ahead and do is call Don's web service, basically retrieve data and dynamically populate the page. So to do that, first thing we're going to go ahead and do is actually add the Atlas core library into our page. And we're just going to do that using a standard script reference to Atlas core. And this provides kind of our core base class library, if you will, in JavaScript for Atlas. And then we're going to go ahead and point at the web service that Don just built using Indigo. And again, we're also just going to go ahead and point at it using a script reference. This is logically like an add web reference today, except in this case here, the proxy is going to be in JavaScript. And once we have that imported, we're then going to write some client-side script events. And specifically, we're going to write a button handler, a button click handler, that will fire whenever someone on the client hits the button. And what we want to go ahead and do inside this button event handler is just get access to the text box value using standard document.gilliman by ID JavaScript APIs, and then call into the Indigo service proxy that we just imported at the top of our page. And the way we'll do that is just calling lapService.matchProcess, so same method is on the server, pass in the parameter, and then we'll pass in one extra thing, which is a pointer to a function to call back to when the data populates on the page. And this way we're not synchronously blocking the browser thread. And within this completion method then, we're going to very simply get access to the span element that we have a little bit lower on our page where we're going to put the output. And then we're just going to go ahead and use the results that return from the server, loop over them, and manually build up a process list that we'll go ahead and splat into our page. And one of the things you'll notice as Chris is typing is he'll be able to actually use a kind of a nice JavaScript object model that mirrors kind of what Don was using on the server to describe process info. So I don't need to manually parse anything or pull anything out. Instead, he can just go ahead and say results.getLength, and then use results sub index of name.
Uh-oh, someone says we have an error.
I think we have a test position open for you, sir.
Yes. So you do the job, you tell us what we did.
No, it is right.
It is
right.
Correct code. So if you use a web service proxy today and you hit it, you get back this big document full of wisdom with all these angle brackets and wackiness. Yeah. And here we've passed an argument to it. We said /JS, and it's going to return the JavaScript proxy automatically.
It's the JavaScript equivalent of *WSDL.
It is exactly that.
Thank you for noticing and scaring us.
Yes. This is an interactive session. I don't think we have any keynotes with that.
Code on the fly. So the last thing we're going to go ahead and do is let's just add a wire up our event handler to the button. And fingers crossed when we go ahead and run this now. And hit it with the browser. We're going to go ahead and, again, we're not doing any postbacks. We're not refreshing the entire page. Instead, what we basically have here is our simple process explorer. Type in a little filter query. Say all processes that start have an A in it. Hit search.
Ooh.
We get back the list of processes from John's Indigo service. Find it on the client. Yeah. Pretty easy stuff. Let's go ahead and make this UI though a little bit richer. And so specifically what I want to go ahead and do is manipulate the UI slightly so that instead of having just kind of a boring list that we're kind of manually populating of processes on the left, we're going to make it a little bit prettier and templatize it. And I specifically want to implement kind of a master details relationship where I can go ahead and drag and drop processes from the left-hand side and use drag and drop as the metaphor to pull in details on the right-hand side about those things. Do it entirely on the client, do all the data binding on the client, not do any postbacks to the server. Now, if you're doing that today, chances are that's going to take you a long time to get right and specifically test and make sure it works in all browsers. Nice thing with Atlas is we make it really easy. So what we're going to go ahead and do to actually help with that is we're going to go ahead and import a new control library here that is built on top of ASP.NET 2.0 that encapsulates kind of the Atlas client runtime. And so specifically, we're going to have the script manager, and all this does is just going to keep track of which JavaScripts to pull in and page in on the fly, and so that way you're not downloading all the client libraries that you need to. You only download the ones you need for your particular page. And then we're going to go ahead and replace this little span in the basic span at the bottom of the page with two new controls that we're going to go ahead and add right now. And specifically, these controls are the Atlas List View control and the Atlas Item View control. And what the List View control does, they're templated. We can see just right here, though, we can see kind of the basic functionality. Provides kind of a core way that we can go ahead and provide kind of a data binding on the client list that's templated, and the item view lets me pull up details about an individual item. We use CSS for styling all styles, so we're deeply embracing CSS as kind of the core way that we customize UI and integrates nicely with designers. And so you can see right here, we've also then added a behavior, which is going to be our drag-drop behavior. And so we're saying the list view is exposing a data source called process, and the item view supports a drag-drop of process data into it. And that's all we need to do. Last but not least, we'll then just go ahead and write some code to populate this. We're going to do this code on the client. So we're going to write all these server controls now expose client-side object models that you can take advantage of. This results control here, we're just going to access its .control property and then set data on it and pass in the results that we pulled in earlier. And with that, when we go ahead and run our page, we search for the A's again. Notice we have a slightly nicer little presentation. Drag and drop, pull up the details. Yeah. Thanks. So obviously, this is a very basic UI. We're trying to show typing everything in front of you. And again, because it's based on CSS, it's really easy to go ahead and customize it and make it much richer. Now, there's one thing missing, I think, from this app, which is, any true, obviously, AJAX app needs to have a map integrated into it, right? And when Don and Chris said the original idea was, hey, we're going to show working set and thread counts, frankly, I couldn't come up with any realistic scenario how you'd integrate a map on first thought. And actually, on second thought, I couldn't come up with a better one either. So instead, what we decided was, well, let's just be a little creative, and we're going to go ahead and add into this item view one extra control that's built into Atlas called the virtual earth control. And for this scenario, we're just going to map the longitude and latitude of our running processes on our server. Common thing. Why not? And so now we go ahead, search for processes. Where's that lap server running? Hey, it's at the PDC. It's not terribly useful, but it's pretty darn cool. So we've shown everything so far now with IE7. And so obviously, as Chris covered in Bill's talk, we've added a lot of investments to IE7. It's a much, much richer browser. I think a really great browser experience. But obviously, if you're building a web app, you want it to be available to any type of browser client.
Including IE6?
IE6 including, but...
IE5.5?
We often say that's cross-platform or cross-browser here at Microsoft, and it turns out most people don't really believe that. So we're actually going to show it with a different machine, and we're actually going to pull up Macintosh. This is going to run running using Safari, so the built-in browser within the Mac. You notice it has the home page that's on the ASP.NET site today, where you can actually download the Atlas project library and run it on top of ES 2005 and ASP.NET 2.0. What we're going to go ahead and do is actually just browse to the page that we built just a little bit earlier. Notice it looks basically the same. Let's search for processes of type A. Hey, it looks kind of the same. Let's drag drop. There's the virtual Earth. Let's move the virtual Earth around just to show it's real. So basically, you're seeing the exact same app, the exact same code running against our server. Works the same. So Atlas enables you to build cross-browser apps very, very easily, as you've just seen. Atlas is also going to go ahead and enable you as a developer to take further advantage of some of the features that are in Windows and the new versions of IE. So specifically, you can build new Windows sidebar components using Atlas. You'll also be able to drag and drop Atlas controls from within the browser onto the sidebar and dock it persistently within the shell. And last but not least, we're looking at exposing some of the built-in Windows data services, things like a local store for offline data, as well as things like My Photos and My Calendar contacts, and provide them in a secure way that browser clients can take advantage of using Atlas, nicely integrate your overall experience, and give a really great developer story. So hope you enjoy Atlas.
Excellent. All right.
Yeah, thanks.
So,
thanks.
Thanks. I love the web, but I also love Avalon. And I think that is its real name, unlike, you know, the... Anyway.
No, you... Avalon.
Avalon, yes. So I'd like to build a smart client built on top of Avalon. And what we need to do first is, unlike the simple web platform that we're able to target now, we understand in the client a richer set of protocols. So what we can do is, in our server side, if you would, please, using that great config system, add in a couple more endpoints. And we're just going to have some bindings so that we can talk natively with the WS star protocols, which will let us do better security and let us do some other features like that. So we've got those plumbed in. That looks great. Let's build and run that, and we're done with the server now. So you get to write no more server code, Don. The rest of this stuff is going to be UI and glitzy.
Which is where I excel.
It is. Excellent. So be good. A new instance of Visual Studio. We're going to create a project. One of the template types in the link preview is a WinFX application, which defaults all the Avalon and Indigo bits in. So if you could call that lap client, and let's create the new project. Wonderful. It looks beautiful. So what we want to do is play around with various UI apps and open some windows.
Thank you.
If we can go to lap client, what we want to do is take that same contract we defined on the server and use it on the client. So Don's going to drag in a contract.cs, which is the exact same contract we had in the initial on the server side, and an app config. So just like on the server, how we can separate out the protocol and everything else about the binding to an Indigo service, on the client we can do the exact same thing. So if you would please import that. Excellent.
Cool.
It's a new word. It's okay. And now we want to use this function, right?
Yeah, so let's go create connect to the server.
Let's create a connection to the server. So connections to the server, you start by creating a channel. That channel is defined by the contract. So here we're going to create a new lap contract. We're going to say channelfactory.create, give it the type of the contract, and then we're going to give it the name we specified in the app config. This is the level of indirection so that we can do the change under the covers about protocols or security models or anything else. So we've got that. We can do a results. We can do a simple query against the channel and call the get processes method. We've got data.
How do we show it, Chris?
I think we should create some XAML. So if you would please open the window1.xaml
And we'll start by creating a simple list box. Excellent. And set the name equal to something. And what we want to do here is now, in the code behind, simply set the item source of that of the processes to be the data we got back from the query. So Avalon natively supports data binding. All of the controls have either an item source or a content property, so you can easily inject data from anything. One of the things we got feedback on was that the Avalon Indigo connection wasn't as good as it should have been. So this is an example where the default proxy that gets generated is natively bindable now. Okay? So if you would, please, run our beautiful application.
Ooh.
Rich visualization. I see it. We have processed data. Not very differentiated.
No.
But before we move on, I'm a little concerned. We're now exposing our process information to anybody out in the world who knows our IP address. And what I'd like to do is have a better security model on here.
Well, this is actually secure already.
Oh, that's true. It is it's the WSHTTP binding, so it's actually doing NTLM or curb off across the pipe. But NTLM and curb off aren't always the most internet-friendly protocols. So what we want to do is use the new info card system that Jim talked about and actually just change that to be the binding we're going to use. So without changing any client code, we're going to rewire that endpoint to point to the info card. And this is going to give us one-click security with federated claims-based identity, right?
Works over the internet, works over different companies.
Internet, goes through firewalls, does all this stuff. You can choose to trust whoever you want. So we get the UI that pops up, we choose the info card we want, we hit submit, and now this has sent the query back with the additional credentials that were specified in info card. And that could have come from any provider.
Yes.
So it's still, we still haven't solved the visualization problem. And for now, let's go back to the NTLM so that we don't have to deal with the UI popping up, just switch those back. But what I'd like to do is create a template, create some UI definition for our processes. So if you would please create a listbox.item template. And inside there, we're going to create a data template, which allows us to specify how we want to visualize something. We're going to put a simple text block in it, bind it to the name attribute, and then run this. So again, still not quite exciting enough, not quite there, we'll work there, but you have to appreciate what this is doing, right? We know on the server, it's taking CLR objects, metadata from a database, remoting it over Indigo, visualizing it here, and doing data binding natively in Avalon. That's pretty good experience so far. But we need that rich visualization, the developer-designer split that you talked about earlier. So if you would please go to myapp.xaml, and we're going to replace this empty file with a pre-canned one. Our graphic designer, well, a PM on our team, spent a good amount of time creating a nice look for this app. And what we want to do is, the last thing we need to do is change the item template to be bound to the resource that he gave us. And he said it's going to be called process view. So this really allows, you could have a designer continually work on that file without affecting your application at all. So if we run, we're going to see a very different look to the app.
Didn't need to change the code, correct?
No code changes at all. So we can see a couple of things here. First off, we have styled scroll bars. We're able to do nice effects like blurs, images, gradients, all of the stuff that you'd expect out of a nice 2D graphics platform. But this is really all kind of UI-based. It looks like a list box still, all of these things. What we want to do is we want to go to kind of the next level. We want to do something that actually integrates some documents in. Before we do that, however, we need a little space on our screen. One of the pieces of feedback we got last PDC, very loudly, very repeatedly by many people, was that we didn't have enough of the basic controls in the box. So I'm happy to say that in the PDC build that you're getting, there's going to be list view control, tree view control, month calendar control, all of those high-value controls are in the box. In addition, we've added a grid splitter, which will allow us to dynamically resize the UI, which is another feature that people really requested a lot. So if you would please put a content control in here. This is going to host our document that we're going to create, give it a name, and set the grid column.
Cool. Now what do I do, Chris?
So instead of creating the data binding program in markup, what we want to do is actually dynamically generate the code. So it's a little bit of code, so if you would please paste a snippet.
If you look, really all this is doing is it takes the result of that query, that process data list, and it does some link queries against it, creating a set of paragraphs and runs and bolds, and this programmatic manipulation of a document tree. Fairly straightforward. What we want to do, though, is take that document we just created and make it be the content for the view. So if you would, call create content, give it the results. Looks very nice. And now if we would run. It's thinking.
And working.
So what we see is a nice document view. And if you would, Don, why don't you, it's selectable. Can you page around in it? You can scroll. You can see that Avalon automatically figures out the right number of columns to display for the document, provides a paginated view. All this gives you a rich document platform that's directly integrated with the same programming model that you had for all the UI elements, bound to the same data. Right?
Love it.
It's great. So, thank you. You know, there's a saying, right? There's all of the Ajax app must have a map, and all Avalon apps must somehow incorporate 3D. So again, we have the task of how do we integrate 3D into a great app about mapping your processes. And so we have a little version here, which if you'd launch that, please, Don. We see on the right-hand side, we have third pane. If you can maximize the window, give us some real estate. We can see that we can fly around the 3D view on the right. It's not looking very interesting yet. Ah, that's better. And if you would please resize the window on the left, you can see that that's all live data. You can select it. You can scrub it. But you know, that's actually a full 3D object. So if you would right-click on the side on the right, and there's actually something under there. So if you'd fly down a little bit closer, we can see there's something there.
But I can't. What is it?
I don't know. Would you please right-click and let it get out of the way? Ah, yes. Whereas they have virtual Earth in Atlas, we have real Earth in Avalon.
Love it.
Excellent.
And so, it was wonderful to see all those Win32 processes enveloping the globe.
Yes. Yes, Win32 does encompass the world.
Yes.
So really, what we've seen is on the presentation side, a programming model that spans all the different areas of execution you need with Atlas and Avalon. We have a unified programming model for dealing with communication. It lets two pieces of software talk with Indigo. And in the data side, we have a great new integrated query model with Link. You know, 2 years ago, we were on the stage, and we announced a bunch of new technologies, Avalon and Indigo included. And you guys talked to us. You told us what you didn't like, what you liked, and we really listened. We hope that the stuff you've seen here, the POCs, the control sets, things like that, show that we have been listening to what you guys have been saying. We've announced some new technologies today with Link and with Atlas, and if you keep talking, we'll keep listening. Thank you very much.
What do you think about the breadth? Incredible, huh? Well, for the last 40 minutes, you've been seeing these guys write some code. How about looking at a real app? A sample app. You know, in order to test out the platform with this much breadth, I really wasn't sure. I'm asked you guys to dog food, but better if we dog food. So a few months ago, I asked a team inside of Microsoft to take this platform and to write a sample app. And that's what they've been doing. Create a sample app to test the platform so you wouldn't have to. I'd like to bring Hillel Cooperman out so he can talk to you about the work that they've done in that team for the sample app. Hillel?
Thanks, Kent. So when we looked at the, when you gave us this job, which we appreciated, we looked at the platform. We said, wow, Avalon do a lot of cool UI. And we said, Indigo, or Windows Communication Foundation, we can share data between PCs. And we said, well, what would be a great scenario to actually try and make happen in a real application, a real sample app, using that platform? We thought we would let you create visualizations of your photos and share them with other people over the internet.
Good sample app.
All right, so let's take a look. So we came up with a little code name for it. We call it Max. Here it is. So this is, again, 100% managed. All the UI you're seeing is built in WPF. And in fact, you'll notice, since the app is relatively simple, all it does is let you make lists of photos, visualize them, and share them over the internet. We wanted to put something else on our homepage, so we had a little extra time, and because of the productivity we get from the platform, we were able to put a whole kind of newsreader hardwired to our blog, our team blog, right there on the homepage. So that's kind of cool and a good way to communicate with people who are trying out this app. So let's create and share a list of photos. So from a user perspective, you're getting access to the last 7 folders that got updated or created in My Pictures. But what's cool about what's happening under the covers is we're using Avalon's composition features to actually nest views. So you see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 thumbnail views all embedded in one big thumbnail view. And you can see they're even rendering the images at different sizes. And again, that's thanks to Avalon. So let's click here on these images, and just so we can see them all, let's make it a little bit smaller. And now let's add some from other folders. And again, you'll notice this is 2 instances of our thumbnail view, one here on the left and then one here on the right that shows the actual list we're making. And again, the nice thing is we were able to really reuse the controls that we created here because this is a kind of a single-purpose view where you're just adding and removing from the list. So we wanted to put those little hints on the cursor about whether when you click you'll get an add or a remove. And again, that was super easy to do with the platform. Let's add just a few more. Let's see here. And we'll add one more. All right. So now we have a good 65 items in our list. And that's fine. But one of the other things that we get is it's all well and good to have all this data. It's nice that you can make a nice thumbnail view using Avalon. But you really want to be able to make multiple views and have it be distinct from your data. You don't want to have any mixing there. So let's actually pick another view that's maybe more optimized around photos. We call this the album view. And let's zoom it up a little bit. So in fact, what we've done now is laid out all the same images. We haven't touched any of the original data, but laid them out in these templates that make it kind of a nice presentation for slides. You notice maybe this picture doesn't really look good in that layout, so let's move it and swap it over here with this one. Now you actually get the whole image. We can rearrange slides, etc. And again, all this functionality is super, super easy for us to do using this great platform.
Come on, don't you think this is cool? Moving it around? And it comes from the platform, so you didn't have to do all the work.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is, some people sometimes say, hey, you know, that WYSI stuff is, that seems all well and good, but A, was it hard to do? And the answer, like Jim said, is no. But B, hey, is that something that really you want to have? And you got to be careful to balance it. You don't want it to be gratuitous. But in fact, a lot of this stuff really helps you with usability, where you're going and dragging, you know exactly where the thing's going to end up. And that's actually something that helps in an app, whether it's for consumers or in the enterprise. And that's a lot of feedback we've been getting from folks. All right, so let's get a preview of what that's going to look like on the other end of the wire. So when we go share these images over the internet, this is what the other person is going to see. So let's actually, let's go back and let's name this PDC Pictures. Jim. Okay. So we'll hit share. And one kind of interesting thing about this screen is we wanted to actually give people a live view of what they were about to share. So you notice, again, in the upper left-hand corner, a mini view of what we just saw. And again, it's super easy for us to reuse all those components and lay them out in multiple pieces of UI just exactly the way we want. So I'm going to type in your email address right here. Hey, check out these pictures. And I'm going to hit share. Now, this is when we move on from sort of the Avalon portion of our demo and give you a sense of how we're using the Windows Communication Foundation. So if you'll step over to that machine, what's happening is we really benefit from Indigo in that it lets us, in a really low-cost way, create a secure connection, a secure channel between two PCs to replicate these images over to the other PC over the internet. Let's make sure, Jim, you're up on the screen. I think you are.
No, not yet.
Let's see what you got here. I think you're over on this machine. There we go. Just launch Max.
Great.
Great. So we've gone and created that channel using Indigo with a custom data contract and a custom service contract. You go ahead and accept the album. There it is. I was told that if you're standing all the way over there, it'll make it more realistic that the bits are traveling from one machine to another. And in fact, you'll notice what's happening right now is they're handshaking and making sure everything is all okay. And here come all the images replicating over. This kind of communication is relatively standard today and going to become more and more standard, where clients want to be able to talk to each other in a secure, authenticated way and in a relatively lightweight way. And Indigo did a huge amount of the work for us so that we didn't have to do it.
So it's almost done?
Yeah, almost done. 9 more, 8, 7. Well, you can see. There you go. So play that and let's verify that it was exactly what I shared with you. All right, so one more aspect of the app we made that I want to share with you. So the Avalon guys did a great job adding a set of 3D APIs for us. And like Chris Ann said, you can't have an app without using 3D. We wanted to show it in a way that hopefully you'd find super useful. So we added one more view using the 3D APIs. And the nice thing about this is Avalon makes it so that we address our 3D objects with the same programming model as the 2D objects. And that makes it really easy to use. So you can actually see the pictures are not only plotted on 3D, but the reflections under them are live 3D reflections, all plotted on a 2D background. And those little transport controls that you saw are another 2D object composited over the 3D objects that are composited over the 2D objects. So again, all made super easy using Avalon.
Great. Thanks.
Sure. So I know I'm getting the hook. Two quick things. One is we're going to actually have two sessions this week, one at 1 o'clock today over in room 150 on a case study on how we did the UI, and then on Thursday at 1 where we delve into the details and show you a bunch of the code. And the litmus test for this was not just to show it to you, but if it was going to be real, you should be able to use it. So you can actually go download it right now at www.microsoft.com/max.
Great.
Thanks very much.
Thanks again. How about a real app? This is a good sample. How about a real app? Joe Flannery, the Vice President of Marketing from North Face, is here, along with Mark Bellinger, CTO and co-founder of Fluid. And they're going to come out and talk about the problems that they wanted to solve and how they solved them with Windows Vista. Hey, guys.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing good.
Good. Hi, Jim.
Yeah.
Nice to see you.
Hi, everybody. This is new for a guy from the North Face to be at the PDC. And I'm very excited to be here to tell you a little bit about the North Face. We're the world's premier supplier of authentic and innovative outdoor products. These are products that inspire and enable our customers to never stop exploring. The North Face was founded as an expedition brand. And to date, we sponsor more expeditions than all of our competitors combined. We've got amazing athletes like Pete Athens, the American who summited Everest more than anyone else. Pete's an amazing guy, but when he's up on Mount Everest, our customers can't experience what he's experiencing. We've got athletes like Dean Karnazes, the ultra-marathon man, who's running 270 miles at a time, but he's by himself. We also have thousands of products each season, 2,000 this season alone. Sometimes our customers have a hard time understanding the difference between a $100 tent and a $5,000 expedition tent. So we've looked at what's been successful for marketing for us, and the internet has been an astounding tool for us to use. So we briefed our friends and our web design agency, Fluid, to find opportunities for us to figure out how we can bring our customer and our content and bring them closer together and bring it to life. So Mark is going to show you something that's answered our prayers. Mark?
Thanks, Joe. So we've had the good fortune of being the North Face's agency for the past 3 years. In that time, we've been able to use rich internet application technologies to double overall sales volume for the North Face's website. We were able to do that by showcasing all of that wonderful content that the North, Joe was just talking about, via rich interaction technologies. A little bit about Fluid. We design and engineer rich user experiences. Accordingly, we partnered with Microsoft to take advantage of the next generation technologies within Windows Vista to realize this project. With Windows Vista, we're making the media happen. So what is this thing? It's a proof of concept C# app that's written with also XAML that's completely data driven. Nothing you're about to see is canned. And so in that earlier demo, you saw a pretty cool thing with some video playing in 2D. How about some video on 3D? How about three videos in 3D?
About a one.
The longest distance I've run is 10 marathons nonstop, which is 262 miles. I've run across Death Valley.
So as you can see, this is totally dynamic. We find this pretty amazing. This kind of 3D and video is something that's really not very easy for us to develop, especially in web contexts. And before we jump in further, first a confession. Prior to this project, we were web, not Windows app developers. And what we found was an incredibly powerful platform. We're really pleased with the results, and we think you will be too. So as you can see, rich media is really deeply integrated into the Windows presentation foundation. You've got ClearType overlaid on video playing, full screen in the background. Integrating imagery, sound, video often involves just a single line of markup. We were able to introduce these great 3D elements to showcase the North Face's products. And diving into this other product, the Redpoint Jacket, you can see that the original video is rotated into the background onto that plane, and we've overlaid yet another video, a testimonial from one of the North Face's athletes, expanding on why he likes the product so much. That was all written in XAML, and it was very simple to do. So during the course of development, we found the Windows Vista platform to be a very flexible platform development. These user interface components right here, features, expeditions, technology, that I'm circling with the mouse, these are all just list box controls that have been styled. They're the same control. That's incredibly important to us because we're able to rapidly change the look and feel of our applications without a lot of work. And yes, these are two video feeds playing within a list box control.
And if you think about the challenge that I just mentioned at the beginning, this is going to allow us to have that interaction with the customer. So they get the validation from an athlete, see amazing product detail, but also see a 3D animation on how the fabric technology works.
So according to what Joe was talking about, this is the product rotation. Pretty cool. Really important for online people to be able to see products at that level of detail. And this is simply an image montage control we wrote. It's the same control that you saw at the very beginning of the demo that showed the images fading around. And if you look really carefully in the background, that same control is still running, subtly reinforcing the North Face's aspirational brand. So we're going to have to go soon, but there's one last point I want to leave you with, and it's one of the most important for us, and I think it will be for you too, and that's on developer productivity. Tools that make us highly productive are critical to our success. And doing things like this kind of 3D and video mapped on it, was not practical in our previous projects. So for this project, remember I told you that we were web developers. The primary developer went from zero Windows application development experience and zero 3D experience to this in fully functioning prototype form in a mere 6 weeks. That's simply astounding. And the productivity gains are only going to increase because of the new workflow development, where you have XAML separated for handling the layout and then logic on the same, on this other side. So what you're going to get is that engineers can concentrate on code and let the designers worry about pixel twiddling. These kinds of deeply immersive customer experiences are what customers demand and are critical to success for online retail. Courtesy of Windows Vista, because of the deep media integration, the flexible platform we were able to develop from, and the resulting developer productivity gains that we were able to eke out, We're only going to be moving faster in this space.
We see a tremendous opportunity at the North Face, not only online with our website design, but also at the point of sale. With this content and this interaction, we're going to blow away our competition.
So we're sure you guys have some questions. We'll be in the exhibit hall if anyone wants to come by and understand how we built this thing. Before we go, we want to thank the North Face and Joe's team for the inspiration, and Jim and the Microsoft team for providing us with the tools to visualize it.
Thank you. Awesome.
Thanks.
You just saw the future of Vista applications. Once people get a view of this, that's what they're going to demand. We're going to post on MSDN a white paper explaining how this app was written later on today. So, given this, users are going to expect a certain minimum set of capabilities when they have a Windows app. I can't possibly cover all the details. In fact, that's why we're having this conference. You're going to get specific information, very precise, about what you should do in order to enable and take full advantage. Now, there's a few things that I do want to highlight to just make sure that you did hear me earlier. It's going to be critical that you make your app run a standard user. We are committed to security, and we're going to make that the default. But there's so many other things, like taking advantage of the iFilter interface so that you can pull out the metadata, or taking advantage of the search controls in your app, or configuring your app when you happen to be on battery, or taking advantage of the ability for the system to be in portrait or landscape. All those things are covered in the different sessions here. Okay. This is going to be an amazing release. It hasn't been since 1995 and Windows 95 that we've produced an operating system that had features for every audience. In the IT pro space, think about all the work that we're doing in servicing and deployment and security. For the information worker, think of all the search and organization and visualization, or even the simple meeting apps that experiences that we're going to put in the system. Consumers, all the games that are going to be there, the photos, the music, the video, all that. And it hasn't been since Windows 95 that we've had this rich an API for you. The opportunities listed on this slide are mind-blowing. Analysts forecast that within the first 24 months of Windows Vista shipping, there'll be greater than 475 million new PCs shipped. That's almost half a billion. A half a billion PCs. We anticipate 200 million bottom line case that are going to be upgradable. That's opportunity for us together. In addition, it's been a long time since enterprise has really gone through an upgrade cycle. It was really since Y2K, and they're ripe to go through that transition. In addition, the fact that we're having Vista and Office 12 coming out about the same time will, in fact, incent enterprises to consider the upgrade now. You saw these demos in terms of the apps. Customers are going to expect that. We're trying to provide the platform for you, but it really is up to you. We think we've got the right platform. Now you need to take it. Build on it. We're going to invest like never before. This is going to be the largest demand generation that we've ever done. We're going to do innovative things that we haven't done before. We've created a $100 million dedicated partner co-marketing program. And the goal is to drive the development of breakthrough apps using features available only on Vista. We're going to be gathering feedback at this conference, and then we're going to finalize how we're going to run this program before the end of the year. If you want to participate, send mail to winshow@microsoft.com. You'll also hear about it more at this conference. We want to be able to have apps showcased in all the different audiences, whether it be in consumer or enterprise. Another way we can help is to connect you with customers in a friction-free way. Today, how many people really buy software and download it over the internet? Some, but not as many as if we really had the infrastructure in place to do it. We released Windows Marketplace last October, and it was a good start. but it really didn't have any download capabilities. And how many of you have downloaded a piece of software and purchased it? Wow. Aren't you worried about the key? What if you lose it? You don't have the media. That is actually preventing some of the acceptance of that particular approach to purchasing software. Today, we're going to preview something we call the next generation of the Windows Marketplace called Digital Locker. And the concept is that you can, in fact, try, download, and purchase software online, and we will keep the information so that you feel safe. If you're moving from machine to machine or something happens to your machine, that you can get the keys back. We're doing that through partners today, and you could start using those partners as part of the preview by engaging with Digital River and eCelerate. There's more information at this at WindowsMarketplaceLabs.com. Now, I think the best way to really explain what I'm talking about here is to show it. So I'd like to invite Dee Dee Walsh out to have a demo of the Digital Locker.
Hey, Jim.
Hi.
Thank you. Hi there. I understand I'm the only thing between you and lunch, so I'm going to show you how fast it is to purchase software through the Digital Locker. So I'm going to go ahead and purchase a piece of software called AC/DC. And of course we have passport authentication. And let me just do my pass. AC/DC, you buy ACD software. And this is a piece of software that will hopefully come up quickly, that is a graphics package. And I am going to go to a different machine, actually. All right, let's try that again. So I'm going to, again, search for this product called AC/DC. And it's a cool graphics package. And there I go again. This always happens when you're in front of a crowd of thousands of people. And here it is. And it's a cool graphics package. I know I want to buy it, so I'm going to click Buy. And I already have a product called Rad Combo Box, which is a developer tool. And I'm going to go ahead and keep this going quickly, so I'm going to check out. And notice that, again, this is just trying to make it very simple and easy for customers to feel like this is a trustworthy service. So I'm going to go ahead and keep moving with this purchase and authorize my stores and complete the purchase. And now what you're seeing happen is the transaction being passed to Digital River and eCelerate. And what's great about this is that it's one transaction for multiple merchants. And the other thing is, while we're launching today with Digital River and eCelerate, ultimately we will have many merchants that will be available. In fact, hopefully the merchants that your customers are most comfortable with. And in this case, again, what's happening here is we're passing an encrypted information to both of these vendors. Now here is the thing that we've all been waiting for, which is just a one-click download. So all I have to do, this was per Jim, he said one click, that's all we want, and there we go. One click, and now I'm in my Digital Locker. And I just want to point out a few things in my Digital Locker that are key. The first is that it's integrated in with the Windows Vista shell. And what that means is that we have a very reliable download through Windows Update services. The other thing is that I'm going to show you a few things. Notice that I can look at all of my products in the Digital Locker. In fact, if you'll see here, it shows the status of each. For example, Synchro Magic Pro from Gellosoft, it says verified. What that means is that we verify that the bits as ISVs that you give us actually are what the customer will get. The final thing I want to show you is what a customer can do in the Digital Locker. The first, obviously, at the bottom is to download the software. And the second is to create a backup CD, which our customers have said, got to have the bits in hand. And of course, the third thing is to be able to install from within the Digital Locker. And the final thing, which is the most important, which Jim mentioned, is getting my license information. So never again do I lose my license information and have to repurchase software. It's all available from here rather than stuck in some desk drawer or hidden in email somewhere. And in fact, if I buy a new PC, all I have to do is sign into the digital locker and boom, there's all my software and I can download it to my machine. So that's the digital locker. I have, again, what, as Jim pointed out, please go to WindowsMarketplaceLabs.com to get more information to test this service out. And also, our team is here at Ask the Experts on Thursday at 6:30, so we'd love to see you. We're here all week. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. Basically, I'm not going to cover all the things on this slide. Bottom line, we're listening. Keep talking to us. We are also trying to have fun, as you can see with the Channel 9 guy. If you have better ideas for having fun, just let us know. We're listening. These are the places to go to give us feedback. So, today, you're going to get more bits than you ever have from us. As you leave, you'll get the goods. I feel like I'm pulling out a wallet here. Okay? You're getting everything from Beta 1 Vista to SQL Server to the tools, the WinFS betas. You'll also get that build 5219, which is the pre-Beta 2 build of Windows Vista. Again, I want to caution you, put it on test machines only. You'll also get some other bits at the end of day 3. So, during the last 2 hours, which is about what it's been, it's a whirlwind tour through the magic of what we think of as Windows Vista and all the associated tools around it. We're going to make it the most successful launch ever. But there's one thing that we can't do, and that's you. We need your apps. We've created the platform, but we need the apps that are immersive the way customers expect. I want to thank you for your past support of the Windows platform. Sincerely, thank you. And I'm excited to see the kind of apps like you just saw here that you create. Have a great PDC and have a great lunch. Thank you very much.